This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll examine what's called autonomous weapon systems, which its opponents call killer robots, and how they relate to the laws of war and the steady escalation in the possibility of nuclear warfare in the United States. We will also get an in-depth legal analysis by former National Lawyers Guild President, attorney Marjorie Cohn, on both partisan gerrymandering and the census question, which was recently decided by the Supreme Court.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We're starting off today's program with an editorial that I wrote, which I'd like to share with you, and it has to do with Trump on the 4th of July bringing fighter jets and tanks into the streets of Washington, D.C. The editorial is entitled, "The Decline and Fall of the American Empire." If a modern-day Gibbons were to write about the decline and fall of the American Empire, she would surely feature Trump's bringing road-crushing Abrams tanks and F-15 fighter planes into Washington, D.C. Gibbons wrote about Julius Caesar, who brought his imperialistic troops into Rome. To do so, they had to cross the Rubicon River. This ended the Roman Republic. Today, July 4th, 2019, symbolically marks the American crossing of the Rubicon. You can't have democracy at home and imperialism abroad. That was the lesson of Gibbons' three-volume history, but that won't be discussed on Fox and Friends, so Trump will remain ignorant. The rest of us should be scared. If there's a shattering event in our country, those tanks and planes will be aimed at us. The Pentagon is developing for future deployment a variety of autonomous weapons systems. They are known by their opponents as killer robots. They will be active in the air, on the land, and on the sea. Killer robot deployment potentially conflicts with the laws of war. The Navy, the Air Force, and the Army will all have them. The robots will use algorithms and artificial intelligence. Once deployed, they can operate for months on their own, monitoring, selecting, and destroying targets, including people. Here to speak with us today about the legality, morality, and wisdom of deploying fully autonomous weapon systems is Michael Clare. He is a professor emeritus of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and a senior visiting fellow at the Arms Control Association. He will be speaking about the dangers killer robots pose and the possible strategies for their control. Michael Clare, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
The U.S. Department of Defense describes an autonomous weapon system as a, quote, weapon system that once activated can select and engage targets without further intervention by a human operator, end quote. Michael, please describe the kinds of weapons that the Navy, the Air Force, and the Army are currently developing.
So each branch of the armed forces is developing their own systems to meet their own needs, and they have different needs. The Navy is developing a whole new fleet of unmanned surface ships. That's in the new budget for fiscal year 2020. They're going to spend billions of dollars on these ships. They're going to send ships out to sea with no crew for the first time in their history. And these ships are intended to hunt down and kill enemy submarines. And we could talk later about the implications of this for nuclear stability and the nuclear arms race. The Air Force is developing what they call a loyal wingman. That is a armed drone plane that would accompany American fighter planes on deep strikes into enemy territory to shoot down enemy planes and attack enemy radars and missile sites and so on to allow U.S. planes to go deep into Russian and Chinese territory. And the Army is developing logistical systems to carry equipment and later to shoot at people also in heavily contested territory. So I want to emphasize in all of this that the military is looking to use robots, autonomous weapons, in high intensity, highly competitive warfare with Russia and China. That's their objective.
What laws apply to their use?
Well, there are a range of laws that really go back to the period after World War I and World War II. The Hague Conventions and the Geneva Conventions. These were international agreements and treaties that said that you cannot use weapons that cause extreme misery and cruelty in war, that use excessive force, and that harm civilians disproportionately. In particular, disproportionate force out of disproportionate to the military objective, and also that you be able to discriminate between combatants in warfare, the enemy you're fighting, and any civilians caught in the area, and you're obligated not to harm civilians unnecessarily. Those are the principal laws that we're concerned with.
Has there been any consideration of applying these laws to the Pentagon's development of these killer robots?
Absolutely. Now, the big concern here is that these weapons, autonomous weapons systems, once deployed, will not be able to abide by those international expectations of proportionality and discrimination. A human can, just by looking at somebody, see if that's a militant, a combatant, just by their posture, how they're dressed, and distinguish that person from a civilian who's caught up in the fire. Can machines ever be able to make that distinction? I don't think so. The advocates for these systems say, yes, we'll develop algorithms in time that'll be so perfect that they'll be just as good as humans in distinguishing a combatant from a non-combatant. But I don't believe it. I don't believe that machines are capable of doing that, and therefore I don't think we should be allowed to use such systems in warfare. And there is a movement organized in particular by the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots to disallow the use of these weapons. And the campaign has been very active internationally through a venue known as the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, CCW. Now, I know that's a mouthful for listeners. Convention is another word for treaty. This is a treaty that the United States has signed, the CCW, Certain Conventional Weapons. That treaty says the U.S. and other signers should not use weapons that are conflict with international law. And a whole set of protocols have been established, landmines, blinding lasers, that would not be allowed under international law. The Campaign to Stop Killer Robots is saying that under that treaty, a protocol should be adopted to prevent, to disallow, to ban the deployment in warfare of fully autonomous weapons systems. There have been a series of negotiations. There have been some recently in Geneva, and these have not succeeded in arriving at such a protocol because the negotiations are by consensus, and the U.S. and Russia in particular have blocked any such agreement. So now an attempt will be made, I believe, to establish an international treaty blocking these outside of the CCW process.
One of the leaders of this campaign is a woman who won a Nobel Prize for outlawing landmines. What can we learn from what she did?
Well, this is Jody Williams, who's done a remarkable job and succeeded in motivating the international community to adopt an international treaty banning those types of weapons, precisely on the grounds that they infringe on laws of war that I described earlier. An attempt, I think, is going to be made now, with her support among others, to do the same thing with autonomous weapons. I fear, however, that while many countries have agreed to this, Austria, Brazil, Chile are in the lead, the ABC countries, and many others, dozens, have agreed to this. But the leading pursuers of these weapons, the U.S., China, and Russia, Israel, South Korea, among others, the U.K., seem to be unwilling to agree to such an agreement and are going hellbent to develop the weapons and deploy them on the battlefield.
Apart from their legality, Professor Klar, please talk about the morality of using these weapons.
There are many dimensions to the morality question. The ultimate moral question for many of us is, do we ever want to trust machines with life and death decisions? Now, this could be as simple as a drone being equipped with the capacity to independently of human control go out over the battlefield and select by itself people to kill. And which the very thought of this is terrifying. Now, listeners will say, well, what's being done now is immoral, and I agree with them. We have drones that go out across Afghanistan and Pakistan and Somalia and Yemen and other places that are directed by human operators in Nevada and elsewhere who look at the imagery that they're getting, and they see people on the ground who are on a wanted list, some that the CIA has developed of militants, and can order the drones to fire lethal munitions at those wanted people. In many cases are killing not only the militants who are wanted for whatever reason, but their families, their friends, their colleagues, and their families. At, for example, at weddings, this has occurred. So that's, you could say, that's immoral to begin with. But there is still a human operator who can say, wait, there are too many civilians there. Let's abort the mission and postpone it for another occasion. And we know from people who have interviewed those human operators that they find this deeply troubling and a harsh job to have, to be in that position to make life and death decisions, even though they're 5,000 miles away from what's happening. All right. Now, the next step is to take humans out of the loop entirely and give machines the power to make those decisions. They'll carry with them a file of wanted militants and to be sent off independently, simply to and have the power to make their own decisions. The machines have the decisions to kill. Well, you could say, well, some commander somewhere gave the machine the authority to go do that, but I find this a level of inhumanity and immorality too much to bear.
You know, last week, Michael, I went to the cardiologist, and I drove home through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, now renamed the Hugh L. Carey Tunnel. You've probably never heard of Hugh L. Carey.
Oh, I did.
Well, he was an associate of Roy Cohn's, named a tunnel after him. I got to go through it every day, and it has face recognition capacities. So the government knows who I am because I went through the tunnel, and they have the capacity to get my medical records from the Patriot Act. And so now they know what my cardiologist found even before I got home. And they can do the same thing with face recognition with these drones. So they can set a drone in motion looking for a particular person and kill them.
It's more complicated than that, Michael, because If you speak to people in the tech industry, they will tell you that there are built-in biases in the training, this word they use, they train the algorithms to identify people. So they might be very good at picking out a white male like you, but they're not so good at picking out Islamic-looking people because they're just not very, the images that they've been fed and the biases of the white male trainers in Silicon Valley who educated, all this in quotation marks, which I can't show on air, the training of the algorithms are done by white males for the most part, who have built-in biases. So they may be very good at identifying you with facial recognition, but they're not necessarily going to be very good at identifying a Muslim militant in Yemen and may easily mistake a farmer out, you know, with his plow for a militant with a gun or a machine gun and kill the wrong person.
In the case of militant Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an American citizen, they were able to identify him, and they executed an American citizen. And then 2 weeks later, they executed his 16-year-old son. So these things are really frightening. Michael, let's talk apart from the legality and the morality of using these machines. Let's talk about the wisdom of using them.
So far, we've been talking about small-scale battles. What I worry about, I work as a visiting fellow at the Arms Control Association in Washington, D.C., and my focus there really is nuclear escalation, the onset of nuclear war. And what I worry about most is that the deployment of these weapons of the kind I was describing earlier, unmanned submarines and aircraft, could hasten the escalation of war from a non-nuclear to a nuclear conflict. And this, in my mind, is the greatest danger we face from the development of these technologies, because it's speeding up the pace of war and leading military commanders to rely increasingly on machines to make decisions in crisis moments. And I fear will make nuclear escalation more and more likely. For example, I spoke earlier of the ships that the Navy is building, these unmanned, uncrewed, C-R-E-W-E-D, uncrewed warships that they are going to build and deploy. They can build 100 of them for the price of a manned warship, because you don't have to have crew quarters and protection for the crew and all of that. So they're much cheaper. So you can make hundreds of them and deploy them and send them out on the ocean to hunt for enemy submarines carrying second strike capabilities, the ones that are supposed to be the ones that if we attack another country, they could still fire off a nuclear round and so deter our first strike. If you can follow all of this, mutual assured destruction is what it's called. We're eroding that, which means in a crisis, everybody is going to push the button much faster than they would otherwise and start a nuclear war.
How much money is being spent on these autonomous weapons?
By day, you know, it goes ting, ting, ding. It's going up by the billions. So ask me tomorrow, it'll be a billion more.
Well, let me ask a broader question then. What part of the budget of the United States goes into the so-called Defense Department?
So the planned budget, it's still being argued by Congress, but the target for fiscal year 2020, which would begin in on October 1st, is $750 billion.
I suppose relative to the entire budget, that's about half of the entire budget?
Something like that. Now, that includes the armed services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps, and the nuclear component of that, production and safety and so forth of nuclear weapons.
The magazine, The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, has a clock on its cover. And depending on the situation in the world, the hands on that clock go further away from midnight or closer to midnight. And lately, the hands have been pushed closer to midnight. Is this partly due to the development of these killer robots?
I would say it's the result of numerous developments, not just this one. The biggest, most dangerous development is the breakdown in relations between the U.S. and Russia. I was about to say the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and that's not entirely wrong, because it's the breakdown of the agreements that were signed between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Many of those agreements, then taken over by Russia, many of those agreements are falling apart because of the bad relations between Moscow and Washington. And we're at danger of all of the remaining Cold War arms control treaties falling apart, with both sides, the U.S. and Russia, accelerating their development of nuclear weapons. So it's a combination of all of these activities and, at the same time, investment in new nuclear weapons technologies. Now, I could, I could elaborate on all of these. The two biggest concerns right now are the fact that the U.S. has withdrawn from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty, which bans totally the deployment of nuclear, ground-based nuclear cruise missiles and ballistic missiles of a range of between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. These were weapons that wouldn't be used to target each other's homeland, but for use in Europe primarily. And that was a very important treaty because it widened the firebreak between conventional and nuclear war. It made it harder to escalate into a big war from a small war. But the U.S. claims that Russia has violated the treaty. Russia claims that the U.S. has violated the treaty. However, it's an extremely valuable treaty, and it's a disaster that President Trump pulled out of that treaty. And now we're likely to start a arms race in cruise missiles, which will be hypersonic cruise missiles much faster, which means that a future war between the U.S. and Russia, or NATO and Russia in Europe, is likely to go nuclear within a matter of minutes.
What about the breakdown of the Iran deal?
The Iran deal is a disaster and a tragedy in its own right. It doesn't affect the nuclear clock quite so much because, thanks to the Iran nuclear deal that President Obama signed, Iran doesn't possess nuclear weapons. That was one of his great achievements. And President Trump, in his lack of wisdom, I believe, think he could get a better treaty. I don't know what he thinks he could achieve, but whatever it is, it's not stopping Iran from getting nuclear weapons, because Iran didn't have nuclear weapons, thanks to President Obama. So now he's torn up that treaty, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. He's torn that one up, and the Iranians are suffering, and they've chosen to start slowly inching out of the treaty, which they're allowed to do because they can do that if another party has violated, which the U.S. has done. The U.S. has violated the treaty, so they claim legitimately that they're not bound by it anymore. They're not moving yet to full-scale production of nuclear weapons. They're inching that way. I think there's a good chance that the U.S. will attack Iran, but that won't lead to a nuclear war. Let's hope.
How does Israel figure into all of this? It's not a very well-kept secret that Israel is a nuclear power, and it's not a secret either that Israel is an antagonist of Iran. Is that pushing the clock's hands forward?
Well, when you talk about Israel and Iran, you have to talk about Netanyahu in Iran, because Israel, like the United States, is politically divided. There's a big peace movement in Israel, and there are many in the Israeli intelligence and military community who oppose Netanyahu's policies. Netanyahu has staked his political career on antagonism to Iran. That is his, and opposing the Palestinians is his major political thrust. And so he is very eager to drag the United States as his surrogate to fight a war against the Iranians. This is a case of what you call in political science the tail wagging the dog.
Michael, I'd like to ask you a personal question, if I might. How did you get involved in the work that you're doing?
Oh, like so many of my peers from the 1960s, it was the Vietnam War era. I was a student at Columbia University here in New York City in the 1960s and got swept up into the anti-Vietnam War movement. And it made me decide to switch my academic studies from architectural history, which is what I was studying at Columbia, to studying American foreign policy and military policy. And that's what I've done ever since.
Michael, how can people follow your work?
Well, I am the defense correspondent of The Nation magazine, and I write regularly for The Nation and for their website, thenation.com. I also write a blog for TomDispatch.com.
And if people want to get involved in opposition to these killer robots, is there a connection that we can offer them?
Yes. I should say I also write for Arms Control Today. And if people concerned about the nuclear weapons developments I've discussed, they should go to armscontrol.org. If you're particularly interested in the killer robots, there is a campaign to stop killer robots, and just go to campaigntostopkillerrobots.org, and you will be directed to information about that work.
Michael Clare, it's been enlightening and a pleasure to be able to speak with you. But before I let you go, do you have any final thoughts?
My final thought is this. I remember the Cold War well, and some of your listeners may have that memory as well, the days of fearing nuclear strikes and having to hide under our seats in the classroom. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when I was scared for my life in those days. We haven't had that kind of fear in recent years, for which I'm grateful. My son grew up in a world in which nuclear war was not hanging over our heads, and I'm totally grateful for that. But I don't think we cannot assume that nuclear peace is automatic and that it's going to persist. I fear we're moving in the opposite direction. So if our listeners are concerned, want to keep us from going back to a world where nuclear obliteration is a very real possibility, they have to pay attention to these issues and get involved in efforts to stop the escalation of nuclear weaponry.
Thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
It's been my pleasure, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The underlying premise of our radio program, Law and Disorder, is, in the words of our founder, attorney Michael Ratner, that democracy and the rule of law are increasingly becoming incompatible with capitalism and imperialism. A terrible example of this is the recent Supreme Court decision on partisan gerrymandering. The majority decision, written by Chief Justice John Roberts, was joined by his fellow four right-wing pro-corporate authoritarian judges Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. In its unprecedented decision in Rucho v. Common Cause, Roberts wrote that the Supreme Court would not get involved in election rigging matters, although majority rule is a foundation of American democracy. In addition to gerrymandering, another anti-democratic strategy practiced historically in the U.S. has been voter suppression. Most infamously, the Democrats did this during the Jim Crow era to prevent recently freed slaves from voting. Currently, the Republican Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross attempted to suppress votes by including a citizenship question on the census, which occurs every 10 years and which determines money allocations, among other things. In this instance, the Supreme Court recently ruled that the question cannot be asked, but Trump characteristically maintains that indeed he wants it asked and it will be asked. Here to speak with us today from San Diego, California, is retired law professor and former president of the National Lawyers Guild, attorney Marjorie Cohn. Attorney Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Marjorie, the University of California Law School Dean Edwin Chermerinsky has written that, quote, "The party that controls the legislature draws districts for both the United States House of Representatives and the state legislatures, and they inevitably do so in a way to maximize their political control," end quote. How does gerrymandering occur?
Well, gerrymandering occurs when, first of all, there are two different kinds of gerrymandering. There's racial gerrymandering and partisan gerrymandering. Gerrymandering occurs when one party intentionally manipulates district boundaries to skew its voting power, notwithstanding the will of the voters. And the Supreme Court has struck down racial gerrymandering, gerrymandering done to minimize the clout, the political clout of racial minorities, but has not struck down partisan gerrymanders, which are gerrymanders that are set up to favor one political party over the other. And although both parties engage in partisan gerrymandering, Republicans benefit from it far more than Democrats. After the 2010 election, the GOP redrew the maps radically, so that for a long time to come, they will not represent the true will of the voters.
In the recent Supreme Court cases, one in North Carolina involving Republicans and another one in Maryland involving Democrats, what did the legislatures do in those states?
In North Carolina, the Republican legislative leadership drew a congressional map to entrench long-term Republican majorities. And although they won roughly 50% of the popular vote, Republicans picked up a majority of available seats in the 2018 midterms by the extreme margin of 10-3 because of this gerrymandering. And then in Maryland, the Democrats were the ones who engaged in partisan gerrymandering. They used voters' histories and party affiliations to move 70,000 Republican voters out of a district and 24,000 Democratic voters in. And so these are the two cases that were pending in the Supreme Court, the North Carolina case and the Maryland case, in the big gerrymandering case that was just issued by the Supreme Court.
How have advances in technology made partisan gerrymandering far more effective and durable?
Well, according to Justice Kagan, who wrote a very impassioned dissent for the the four liberals on the court in the gerrymandering decision. According to her dissenting opinion, she says that partisan gerrymandering is far more effective and durable now than in the past because of advances in technology that provide map makers with more granular data about party preference and voting behavior than ever before. And she said they can utilize it with unprecedented efficiency and precision. Excuse me.
So what is the test for partisan gerrymandering?
Well, that's really an interesting question because the Supreme Court said, oh, we can't come up with a test. You know, it really isn't fair, partisan gerrymandering, but we just can't do anything about it because there's no test. Well, that's absolutely incorrect because there is a three-part test that Justice Kagan cited in her dissent that federal district courts, including North Carolina and Maryland in the cases that were pending before the Supreme Court, have used around the country to decide these cases. And this test has three parts. It examines intent, effects, and causation. So first of all, plaintiffs have to show that the state officials' predominant purpose in drawing district lines was to entrench their party in power by diluting the votes of the rival party. The second prong of the test is that plaintiffs must establish that the lines drawn substantially diluted their votes. And third, then the burden shifts to the state to put forth a legitimate nonpartisan justification to save its map. So there is a very clear test that the Supreme Court could have used that federal courts around the country have used.
In the two recently decided election rigging cases, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that in his majority decision, which was joined by the recently confirmed Trump-nominated four judges, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, and along with Thomas and Alito, Roberts admitted that partisan gerrymandering, quote, is incompatible with democratic principles. And he also wrote, quote, leads to results that reasonably seem unjust, end quote. But the court held in its majority decision that challenges to the practice, quote, present political questions beyond the reach of the federal courts, end quote. The court refused to address the question. What's wrong with that reasoning?
Well, first of all, federal courts, not just federal courts that I've mentioned, which have decided questions and struck down questions of partisan gerrymandering, but state courts as well have dealt with this and also struck down partisan gerrymandering and haven't said that this is a, quote, political question, unquote, because the courts are not supposed to get involved in political questions. So I think that there is a real political question here, and that is the politics of the judges on the Supreme Court. The majority radical right-wingers on the court wanted to help the Republicans. They know that partisan gerrymandering overwhelmingly helps Republicans, and I think that was the politics that entered into it while they're decrying, well, it looks like it's unjust, but it's a political question and we can't decide it. It was a major cop-out, Michael.
Justice Kagan wrote in the dissent that you mentioned that, quote, for the first time ever, this court refuses to remedy a constitutional violation because it takes the task beyond judicial capabilities. Is this decision on gerrymandering unprecedented, as Kagan charged?
Well, she's right that the court does not shy away from providing remedies for constitutional violations, and this is an example of where it refused to do so, and probably the only example. But in terms of the decision on gerrymandering being unprecedented, the Supreme Court has never actually stepped into partisan gerrymandering, although, as I said, they have decided racial gerrymandering cases. Justice Anthony Kennedy, when he was still on the court in 2004, wrote a concurrence in an opinion which signaled his openness to striking down extreme partisan gerrymanders, which which he said his words amount to rigging elections. And he wrote, "It is not in our tradition to foreclose the judicial process from the attempt to define standards and remedies where it is alleged that a constitutional right is burdened or denied." And so he answers that question squarely. And by the way, Michael, Kennedy's retirement and Mitch McConnell's illegal replacement of Obama's nominee Merrick Garland with the Trump appointee Neil, you call him Gorsuch, and I think that's a better way to pronounce his name than Gorsuch. Neil Gorsuch all but foreclosed the possibility that the court would review partisan gerrymandering.
So is gerrymandering, like voter restrictions and voter suppression, part of a larger, long-standing right-wing conservative Republican project?
Yes. It certainly is. I mean, we have we have Citizens United that allowed unlimited corporate political spending, and then we have the Shelby County versus Holder decision, which gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965. In Shelby County, the conservative, the right-wing majority of the Supreme Court ruled that states with a long history of discrimination no longer need federal approval to change voting laws. And then there has been, of course, a long pattern of voter suppression. And by the way, there's a very recent example of this voter suppression. There are many kinds of voter suppression, including these voter ID laws, requiring people to have elaborate IDs, closing polling places, using short hours, etc. But in Pennsylvania, there was a bill that passed along party lines. It was a Republican-sponsored bill. Nearly universal opposition from Democrats, and it would have banned what's known as straight ticket voting, which allows a voter to cast a ballot for all Democrats or all Republicans. And the voters that traditionally vote straight ticket, there's an option where they can just, you know, vote all Democrat or all Republican. The groups that traditionally vote for Democrats and the ones likely to vote a straight ticket for Democrats are African Americans in inner city Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, also new voters, young voters. And so this was pending before, and Trump carried Michigan. Republicans succeeded in banning straight ticket voting in Michigan in late 2015. In 2016, Trump carried Michigan by 10,700 votes, and in 2016, Trump carried Pennsylvania by 44,000 votes. Well, this bill that was pending before the governor was just vetoed on July the 5th. Only 9 states currently allow straight ticket voting. Texas recently eliminated the practice. So this is an example of voter suppression, and certainly gerrymandering is a glaring example of voter suppression, because what you're doing is suppressing the will of the voters by redrawing the districts in contorted ways to minimize the political and the voting clout of people, of the voters. You know, it's not one person, one vote.
Yeah, I saw a map of the districts in my home state of Wisconsin, and the contortions were really mind-boggling, the way they set out the districts, because the strategy of the Republicans is to put all the Democrats in one area so that they waste votes. And it works, and it helped get Trump elected. Marjorie, you wrote an article on July 1st for Truthout as part of their Human Rights and Global Wrongs series titled, quote, "After Supreme Court Refusal, It's Up to the People to End Gerrymandering." What can the people do?
Well, half of the states allow voter ballot initiatives. Voter advocates can organize campaigns to put measures on the ballot that require independent redistricting commissions so that they would draw these political maps, the districting maps, rather than politicians. And these independent citizen-led commissions are growing all over the country. They're being adopted all over the country. Recently, Michigan, Colorado, Utah, and Missouri drawing fair and representative district maps. Eric Holder, the Obama's attorney general, has spent his time since leaving office launching the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, which is a political action committee trying to unrig this system that has entrenched Republican control of the country's most important swing states. And Holder's group has filed or helped to file at least a dozen lawsuits against gerrymandered maps. And by the way, Holder, now after the gerrymandering decision in the Supreme Court, Holder's strategy is to challenge racial gerrymandering in federal courts and partisan gerrymandering in state courts. And so his group has supported local candidates whose races had implications for redistricting and backed state ballot measures to establish independent redistricting commissions. And in 2018, the Democrats' gains were impressive. Holder's group raised $35 million, helped Democrats flip about 300 state legislative seats, 6 legislative chambers, and 7 governorships. And in 4 states, Republicans lost sole control of state government, and with it, their ability to single-handedly draw new districts. So there are things that can be done to try to blunt the effect of partisan gerrymandering and put a halt to it wherever possible.
Let's turn our attention to the Supreme Court and the census and the question of citizenship. The Supreme Court recently decided that the citizenship question on the census is not going to be allowed. The census occurs every 10 years. What is the data from the census used for? And then let's talk about the decision. But what do they use this data for?
It's used to determine the number of seats each state gets in the House of Representatives, the number of electoral college votes each state will have in the presidential elections beginning in 2024, and how $900 billion in annual federal funds will be distributed to the states for health care, hospitals, schools, and infrastructure for the next decade. So it's very, very significant.
Why was the question of citizenship proposed in the first place on the census? Why did they want to ask that question?
Well, the question is, quote, is this person a citizen of the United States, unquote. So if a person is answering the census form, the census application, they have to answer yes or no. And Thomas Hofeller was a Republican strategist, and he really was the architect of the strategy of adding the citizenship question to the census. After he died in 2018, his daughter found documents and files that revealed that Hofeller urged that citizenship question be added to the census because it would be a disadvantage to the Democrats and advantageous to the Republicans and non-Hispanic whites in redistricting. But Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross went before Congress and basically lied, committed perjury under oath, and said that the reason that they wanted to add the citizenship question to the census was to better and more efficiently enforce the Voting Rights Act. Now, Michael, that doesn't pass the straight face test because the Trump administration has done everything in its power to undermine voting rights, to suppress voting rights, and this is what this Supreme Court opinion is all about. And by the way, I should say that if this question were added to the census, it would deter households with undocumented residents and even households where all residents are documented, but maybe Latino households where they're hassled just as if they were undocumented, and it will deter them from responding to the census. The Census Department's own figures estimate that 6.5 million people could be uncounted if the question is added. So it's very, very significant.
Well, the Supreme Court ruled that it couldn't be asked because the government lied about why it was proposed. But is there still a chance? Trump characteristically won't give up on it and says they still want to add it. What's your take on their chances of getting it in?
Well, that's interesting. The ACLU filed a lawsuit before Judge Hazel in Maryland, who is hearing a challenge to this, the citizenship question based on the racial grounds violation of equal protection because of what Hofeller said, that it would basically hurt Latinos. But that issue of the racial discrimination for the motivation of the census question was not actually litigated in the Supreme Court because it was the government was arguing we have to expedite this, we have to go fast, the deadline is June 30th, we have to print the forms, and in reliance on that, the government's repeated claims that June 30th was the deadline, the Supreme Court expedited it and didn't even hear briefing on the racial issue. And so what happened is that the Supreme Court, and this is interesting, it was a surprise because in April at oral argument, it looked like from the questioning, and you can never tell for sure, but it looked very much like they were going to uphold the citizenship question, that the right-wing majority would uphold it. But meanwhile, after oral argument, but before the decision in the Supreme Court, this information about Hofeller came out. And so John Roberts, probably like his opinion in the, similar to his opinion in the Affordable Care Act, is certainly a radical right-winger, but is also very concerned about the legacy of the Roberts Court and with these racist motives hanging out there. He kind of split the baby, if you will, and voted with the four four liberals to put a halt to the citizenship question unless and until the government, and they found that the reason that the government gave, that Ross gave, was contrived, and they said, okay, we're not going to include the citizenship question, we're not going to let you include it unless the government can convince the court that there is a lawful motive for adding the question. So the Department of Justice lawyers and Wilbur Ross said, okay, well, we really can't do that. We're going to go ahead and print the forms. This deadline has just passed, and we're going to go ahead. And then, unbeknownst to the Department of Justice lawyers, Trump put out a series of tweets saying, this is fake. No, we're going to go ahead. We want to include it. And, of course, he's appealing to his racist, nativist base. Barr, Attorney General Barr, the president's prostitute, chief prostitute, I guess you would say, in the Department of Justice, said, I agree with the president. There are ways that we can add this citizenship question, and you'll know in a few days. The AP quoted a senior official as saying that Trump plans to issue an executive order adding this question in the next few days. The problem, Michael, is that an executive order, while all of this is pending, while the Supreme Court said no, halted the question, and the Constitution gives Congress the power over the census, the president just carries it out, would create a constitutional crisis. And the ACLU filed a lawsuit with the judge in Maryland, Judge Hazel, who is hearing the racist, discriminatory motive part attack on the census. And they are saying, the ACLU is saying in their lawsuit, that the government should be what we call in the law estopped from adding this question because they already came into the court, to the lower courts, to the Supreme Court, continually representing that June 30th was the deadline and we weren't allowed full briefing on the racist motive issue, et cetera. And so it would not be fair for them to go ahead and be able to add it now when they represented that June 30th was the deadline. And the longer this is dragged out, the more it negatively impacts these plaintiffs in the lawsuits' ability to go into communities, immigrant communities, and encourage them to comply with the census. A judge in New York what happened is that the Department of Justice lawyers who were working on this case to defend the question, after they had already come into court and said, we're going to print the forms without the question, they had egg on their face because when Trump turned around and said, oh, we're going to go forward and get the question on there and come up with a valid reason. And so they all, they said, we're off the case. There are going to be new Justice Department lawyers on the case. Well, a federal judge in New York said, no, you're not going to switch your legal team in midstream. And the judge said that the defendants, who are the Trumpies, provide no reasons, let alone satisfactory reasons for the substitution of counsel, and he ordered the lawyers to produce sworn affidavits explaining their departures, and the scuttlebutt is that there are both ethical and legal reasons why they want to get off the case. They don't think it's legally defensible, and it puts them in the position of looking like they lied to the lower courts about the deadline, etc. So that is pending, but I think that we can expect, looking at Trump's record of doing things that are outside the box to the extent that they're illegal, which this would be, and issue some kind of an executive order saying we're going to print an addendum, assuming that they're correct, that the forms have already gone to the printer. And we're talking about millions and millions of forms, and it's going to be very expensive to send out addendums. But he can issue an executive order. Then it will be challenged in the courts. Then the lower courts will in all likelihood put an injunction against adding the citizenship question. It will be expedited to the Supreme Court, and then the rubber will meet the road, and we'll see what John Roberts is really made of.
It's a thrill a minute with this administration, isn't it?
It really is. Unfortunately, it's not a very positive thrill. It's a thrill that harms people, that harms poor people, that harms people of color, that harms people in other countries. Trump is like a one-man wrecking ball, and I understand that he's got Mitch McConnell helping him and William Barr as well. He's doing his bidding, but he's not really a one-man wrecking ball, but He is certainly doing his best to damage everything he can while he can.
Marjorie Cohn, we're coming to the end of our allotted time. I regret having to let you go. Before I say goodbye, how can people follow your work?
I have a website called MarjorieCohn.com, and my books and articles and video and radio interviews are all there. Also, I write a weekly column for truthout.org, so you can subscribe to Truthout, and then my columns go on other blogs as well, TruthDig, Consortium News, ZNet, etc.
That's Marjorie, M-A-R-J-O-R-I-E, Cohn, C-O-H-N, MarjorieCohn.com. Attorney Marjorie Cohn, thank you very much for being on Law & Disorder, and we look forward to having you back.
Thanks so much, Michael. I appreciate it. And keep up your great work.
Thanks. You too. Take it easy.
Thanks. You too. Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.